Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. With Teton Pass out of commission, we check in with businesses and commuters.
It's one thing to make that commute for a couple of days. It's another situation entirely to be thinking about that for months.
We visit Kemmer, where a highly anticipated nuclear power project just broke ground.
I think the eyes of the world are upon us to see how soon we can get this done.
And we kick off primary election season with a new series, The Road to Cheyenne. Every Open Spaces till the primaries will keep you updated with what you need to know. Today, the big picture.
There's been a national trend over the past 40 years or more of uncontested elections and more lopsided victories in state legislative elections.
Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
My name is Conrad Smith. I grew up in Kansas, but I've lived in Laramie for 18 years now. I think that the primary function of public radio, at least in my opinion, is news and keeping public officials accountable. The entertainment is available many other places, but good quality news is not widely available, and I do believe Wyoming Public Radio has the best broadcast news in the United States right now. The service public radio provides is worth paying for, I guess, quite simply. Anybody who listens a lot has kind of a moral obligation to help pay the bills.
Begin or renew your membership on our secure website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Click on the Pledge Now link. Thanks for your support.
Wyoming Public Media now brings you our daily news roundup, delivered right to your inbox. You'll read interesting stories from just down the street and around the state. Subscribe to our daily roundup at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. It's been a week since a section of the highway over Teton Pass catastrophically failed, disconnecting the tourist destination of Jackson from a sizable chunk of its workforce. The Wyoming Department of Transportation says it's on track to have a detour built around the collapse open in a couple of weeks as the agency works on a more permanent fix. As Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman reports, for some businesses, the impacts have been manageable so far. But for others, the way forward is a bit unclear.
On any normal weekday morning in Wilson, a long line of cars would be commuting down Teton Pass and through town on their way to Jackson. But Amy Solzen says this past week has been a little unusual.
It's just quiet. It feels like a ghost town. It's really strange, and it's kind of eerie.
Solzen is the manager at Pearl Street Bagels, a staple for locals and tourists alike. Normally, they're ramping up for the peak summer season when
up to 15,000 cars travel over the pass every single day. So that's a substantial number, and a lot of those people stop.
So when she first heard about the pass closure, her stomach dropped. But it wasn't about the bagel shop, which has been around for 35 years.
My first reaction, to be completely honest, was the bike shop. Just because the access on the pass has, it brings us so much business.
Last October, Salzen and her husband bought Wilson Backcountry Sports just next door. It was a weird winter for backcountry skiing last year, so they were really banking on a strong biking season to make up for that lack of business.
Teton Pass is so unique and iconic, and people come from all over the country to ride those trails. And so without it, why is anyone coming out to Wilson?
Meanwhile, Cowboy Coffee is right on Town Square in Jackson, and co-owner Pete McElwain says not much has changed there.
You know, it's summer as usual. It's getting really busy.
He says they have seen a spike of traffic at their location south of town, which is now right on the path of the new extended commuter route.
Down by the drive-thru, it's very noticeable how jammed up the traffic is heading down towards Hoback.
Only 5 of Cowboy's roughly 50 employees live over the pass right now. While one's been making the drive, the others are waiting to see how the situation shakes out. McElwain says even before the closure, they've been trying to hire more folks who don't have to drive the pass.
If there's an avalanche, if there's a landslide or whatever it might be, or a car accident, a lot of times that coffee shop can't open.
Tourist staples like Cowboy Coffee are in for a busy tourism season. Industry data show overnight bookings are up 11% over last summer. Time will tell if visitors will change their plans because of the pass closure. But Charlotte Reynolds says for the schools, the timing is pretty fortunate. Their last day of school was on Wednesday.
It's one thing to make that commute for a couple of days. It's another situation entirely to be thinking about that for months.
Reynolds is the executive director of communications for the Teton County School District, which employs about 600 people.
Roughly 10% of our employee base lives on that side of the hill.
Teachers over the pass were able to work remotely for their last 2 days. The district offered dry camping and a shuttle over from Idaho. But the majority of people?
They indicated they were either going to drive themselves or had made arrangements with friends or family on this side of the pass.
Jackson Hole Mountain Resort is another one of the area's big businesses, with about 500 employees in the summer. President Mary Kate Buckley says roughly 15% of those folks live in Idaho and need to work in person.
I haven't heard that anyone has not made it over, and I think this is just a great network of employees, and the whole valley is so well networked.
The resort's trying to increase how many people can stay in their employee housing. Employees can now camp in the resort's big parking lot. They're letting people work different schedules and covering some commuting costs for bussers and carpoolers. While the date of the pass's reopening isn't set in stone yet, Pearl Street Bagel owner Heather Gould says she's hopeful it'll all be temporary.
I know that they're working around the clock to make it happen, and there's just so many thousands of people that depend on that road.
She's currently working from home in Alta, which is in Wyoming, but still over Teton Pass. Gould says the closure has got her rethinking having businesses in Jackson while living on the other side. She's already been working to open a new Pearl Street Bagels in Driggs, Idaho.
Depending on how that goes, that might affect whether or not I keep my shops open on the other side.
One thing's clear, the community will have to keep rolling with the punches. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
And now we take a ride with some of those who had to keep doing the commute. Because of the Teton Pass highway collapse, commuters busing from eastern Idaho to northwest Wyoming are being detoured, making a typically one-hour commute 3 hours long. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Filippula-Ankeny caught the bus one morning.
It's just before 6 a.m. The sun is cresting the Tetons. A street sweeper rolls through empty roads, and two women, one dressed business chic, the other in a hoodie, bags in hand, are getting onto the Stark commuter bus in Driggs, Idaho. Wendy Herrera settles into her seat for another three-hour commute, casually chatting with the bus driver about the previous day's delays.
We were stopped in traffic for probably about 20 minutes there, but we got there about the same time.
Okay, thanks.
Herrera's no stranger to the bus. She commutes to Jackson about 3 times a week for work at a bank, but she, like others, has been adjusting to the new route.
So it was just longer. Not any worser, though. I think it's all about attitude.
But the extra time spent commuting comes with a cost. She's the mother of two young children.
It just means, you know, I don't have dinner with my kids and, you know, maybe I can't get them ready for bed.
A large portion of Teton County's workforce depends on the Teton Pass Highway to get to work. Many choosers are forced to live on the other side due to an age-old problem in the county: astronomical wealth inequality and housing prices, some of the highest in the U.S. The other woman on the bus is Wendy Ruiz. She works at a Jackson restaurant and bar named Eleanor's. She used to live in Jackson, but after getting a new job, it didn't make sense anymore.
And it's like no employer housing. I'm living with my family. It's good. Anyways, but nobody expecting this.
This being the pass collapse, which has added another obstacle to her first year of commuting.
It's big impact for everything. I hope this is finished soon because it's hard.
At the next stop, Barry Hillam of Victor boards the bus. The Jackson dentist, wearing a baseball hat and glasses, sits down, opens his tablet, and begins to read.
In the short term, it's been manageable. In the long term, it wouldn't be. I'd have to make a change.
YDOT, the state's transportation department, expects to open a detour in 2 weeks. That will hopefully shorten the commute, close to the typical hour. Weather permitting, the agency hopes to complete a rebuild of the roadway by November. Hillam is grateful for the quick response, but hopes the proposed timeline is accurate. He's losing time with his wife and daughter.
Just having dinner together, living life. Yeah, we'll still pull it off. It'll be okay. We'll see how long this lasts.
Jackson officials have asked commuters to carpool or take the bus to limit the amount of cars contributing to congestion at the Alpine Junction and along the new route. But ridership has been mostly low as the sun sneaks over the Snake River Range. One sharp turn orients the bus north into a canyon, the last stretch until Jackson. Emmy Sorcy sits near the front of the bus. She stuffs three bags on a one seat and floor beside her, a planner and water bottle falling out of one. Puts her earbuds in and nestles into the window. She lives in Victor and manages the Orvis store in Jackson. She's been commuting for about 4 years, opening and closing the store while being available on call. This new commute is not working.
So I'll probably just have to camp. I have some friends I can stay with, and they're very nice for offering their homes open, their homes to us and to me, but I don't wanna disrupt their lives.
While Sorcy hasn't taken up her friends' offers, some have. And local groups are working to provide housing in Jackson for those severely affected by the closure. County commissioners voted unanimously to allow the use of temporary shelters, campers, cars, tents, and such in town. Sorcy said her livelihood is being impacted.
Time is kind of the most important thing to me, and I feel like that's being taken away.
After 3 hours, the bus pulls out of the Snake River Canyon and into the south end of Jackson. Commuters start getting out and head to work. After the workday, they will be hopping back on the bus for another 3 hours home, a 6-hour commute altogether. You can get to Salt Lake City from Jackson in less time. Until the detour is built, possibly even longer, commuters have less time for hobbies, for family, for themselves. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Dante Filippola-Inkney in Jackson.
The Jackson Hole Travel and Tourism Board is covering the bus fee for all commuters across the pass through June 28th. Typically, it costs $8 per ride, or about $100 per month. The much-hyped nuclear project in Kemmer finally broke ground. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Hi, Daryl Brogdon here, host of the Retro Cocktail Hour, inviting you to join me for the music that's always served up shaken, not stirred. Whether it's TV crime jazz or tiki tunes, space age bachelor pad music, swinging soundtracks, or other incredibly strange music, it's on the Retro Cocktail Hour. Saturday night at 6 on Wyoming Public Radio.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we cut through the distracting clutter in the week's news and get to what really matters.
It's sweet, but can we talk about the nipple rings?
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we take the shirt off the news and see what's under there every week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday morning at 10 and Sunday afternoon at 4 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Almost 3 years ago, an unlikely relationship formed between the declining coal town of Kemmer and one of the richest people in the world, Bill Gates. That's because his nuclear company, TerraPower, announced it's chosen Kemmer for a first-of-its-kind power plant. It promised to pump life back into the economy. But unless you're deeply embedded in the energy world, it mostly just felt like a lot of talk. Until this month, when the project finally broke ground, Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan has the story.
Should I take my shoes off?
No.
Okay.
Mark Thatcher opens the door of his gray stucco home in Kemmer.
Don't worry, I had 5 grandkids sprawled out here last night.
Thatcher has kind eyes, a friendly smile.
I had a granddaughter graduate, and can I brag on this?
Photos of 21 grandkids cover his living room wall.
I got to meet the class president, the valedictorian, and athlete of the year all in one pretty little granddaughter. So, you know what I mean? Kemmer's been good for us.
Thatcher built his American dream in this coal town. He worked as an electrician in the mine, bought a house, raised a family, and retired. And he wants his grandkids to have similar opportunities.
If Kemmer's dried up, it's not an opportunity.
Kemmer and coal go hand in hand. So for a while, the town emptied out, mirroring coal's 16-year decline. But now, Thatcher says Kemmer is starting to feel more like when he moved here. New people, businesses, jobs. And he says it's partly thanks to another source of energy, nuclear. 6 miles south of town, TerraPower is about to break ground on its nuclear power project. Brian Muir, Kemmer's city administrator, looks over the crowd of 300 local and national energy stakeholders.
Joy is the word that I feel right now after a lot of uncertainty and getting here.
Muir hired on in 2019. His job? Find a way for Kemmer to survive. That's because the nearby coal plant is permanently closing by 2036, putting a question mark on the future of the Kemmer coal mine that serves it. Muir's hope is for those hundreds of workers to be absorbed by the future nuclear plant, which promises 250 long-term jobs and 1,600 temporary construction jobs.
I think the eyes of the world are upon us to see how soon we can get this done.
That's because it's a pilot project. Conventional nuclear power plants are massive and require a lot of water. TerraPower has figured out a way to make them smaller, safer, more climate-friendly, and cheaper, in theory.
It's working really well inside the computer.
Bill Gates looks on brand with a blue sweater and black-rimmed glasses, motioning to the leveled dirt behind him.
A little bit harder to make it work out there, but that's what we're starting on starting today.
He and the U.S. Department of Energy are the two main backers of the $4 billion project. Gates's vision is for these plants to be the future of America's growing energy demands.
And you're the pioneers that are going to make that happen.
And with that, Gates and Governor Mark Gordon grab shovels.
One, two, three.
But not everyone feels the camaraderie. Across the highway are about 10 trucks flying Trump-themed flags. A dozen or so people stand around a life-size cardboard cutout of Trump. Ashton Anderson from nearby Evanston breaks away to explain.
Well, we just don't like the idea of liberals coming into our state. It's that simple.
And while many agree Gates' politics don't align with Wyoming, Kemmer's downtown is bustling, even just compared to a year ago. Two bakeries, a law office, and a home goods boutique recently opened up. And most businesses say they're doing well, like Tinsky's Fossils. Cody Tinsky is using a small power tool on a fossil.
So most of these fish are covered with rocks, so we have to uncover it.
4 years ago, she didn't know if she could keep the doors open. The town was slow, partly because of COVID.
That was our first year of business, so it was very scary, but we made it through it.
Business is good now. Several customers came in just within a few minutes. Tinsky says she thinks it'll only get better with the nuclear project.
I think it'll bring in new people and hopefully so Kemmer doesn't become a ghost town again.
Construction on the nuclear project is expected to take 6 years, and there are still several large hurdles, like securing a domestic source of fuel, a highly enriched uranium. Right now, it's only made in Russia. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Kemmer.
Four Western states, including Wyoming, are paying farmers and ranchers tens of millions of dollars this year to conserve water. It's part of a short-term plan to save water from the Colorado River, which is shrinking amid two decades of mega drought. But some are skeptical that the federally funded program is worth the money. KUNC's Alex Hager and Aspen Journalism's Heather Sackett report for the Mountain West News Bureau.
During the growing season on Leslie Hagenstein's ranch near Pinedale, Wyoming, water flows in and the fields come to life.
And you have these very lush grasses and you have a canal or a ditch that's full of this beautiful, clear, gorgeous water that comes out of these beautiful mountains. I mean, it's nirvana.
But last summer, the fields were desolate. Hagenstein stood among them
and cried.
Last year, it looks like Armageddon. I mean, it's nothing. It's very sad. There's just no growth at all. There's no green. Everything is brown.
But these barren fields aren't the result of drought. Hagenstein left the fields dry on purpose.
She signed up for the System Conservation Pilot Program and got paid 13 times what she would have made leasing it out to grow hay.
I didn't anticipate it would be so beneficial. It bought us time to stay in ranching is the long and the short of it. So most grateful for the abundance that the federal government offered us.
Those payments are part of a years-long experiment, a way for the government to see how it would go if they paid farmers and ranchers to hit pause on using water in the Colorado River Basin.
But this trial run is expensive, and it's not saving that much water. Elizabeth Kobely researches water policy at the University of Nevada, Reno.
Perhaps we need to be thinking about, rather than temporary conservation, investments in longer-term conservation beyond what we're already doing.
Between 2023 and 2024, the program spent $45 million to save a little more than 1% of the Colorado River water allocated to Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, and New Mexico. Kobely says that kind of money could be spent differently, like investing in new crops that will be able to survive a hotter, drier future.
I'm hesitant to keep pushing for temporary conservation. I think we have pretty clear climate signals that say the basin's aridifying and we need big reductions to water use.
This conservation program has had some troubles, like marketing. A University of Wyoming study published last year showed that 88% of growers in eligible states hadn't even heard of it.
Drew Bennett, who co-authored the study, says that may not have been an accident. It could be part of a broader negotiating strategy. He said the states who run the program might not be putting their all into water conservation until the lower basin states of California, Arizona, and Nevada do more.
I think that they're, you know, basically saying that the lower basin needs to get their act together before we actually really need to come to the table in a realistic way.
Regardless of how much water it's saving, proponents of the program say the real value is in the data and lessons it provides about how to get farmers to conserve any amount of water.
Water policymakers say climate change is shrinking supply, and the region needs to cut back on demand. A program like this one could be a way to do that in the future. Chuck Cullum directs the Upper Colorado River Commission.
We're learning a lot from the program that in the event that people want to stand up a longer-term, durable program, these lessons learned will make that more robust.
But the future might look different when it comes to money. Funding for the conservation program came out of the Inflation Reduction Act, which set aside $4 billion for Colorado River work. That kind of funding is hard to come by.
Leslie Hagenstein, the Wyoming rancher, says growers like her are rare, and a lot of her peers are stuck in their ways.
I'm a Wyoming native. I don't want to push our water downstream. I don't want to disregard it. But I also have to survive in this landscape. And to survive in this landscape, you have to get creative.
And getting buy-in from growers like Hagenstein, that could be a big part of saving water on farms in a region that needs every drop it can get. In Sublette County, Wyoming, I'm Alex Hager.
And I'm Heather Sackett.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced by KUNC and Aspen Journalism, and supported by the Walton Family Foundation. The Road to Cheyenne, that's the name of our new series that will dive into everything you need to know about the primary elections this year, and it's coming up next. Stick with us on Open Spaces.
This is Classical Wyoming, with great music 24 hours every day. If you would like to see the playlist, go to classicalwyoming.org.
This time on The Modern West, we meet an innovative teacher conducting scientific research with her middle schoolers on the Wind River Reservation. They set up trail cameras.
We didn't know what kind of holes they were, but the first pool of the film, they're prairie dogs that were coming out of the hole.
One size does not fit all. It's the final episode of our series, High Altitude Tales. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. Today, we're starting a special series on open spaces that will run till the primary elections on August 20th. We're calling it The Road to Cheyenne, and it's going to be your go-to listen if you're lost amid the run-up of the primaries. Every week, I'll be joined by one of our state government reporters, a regional WPM reporter, and sometimes a political analyst to help us wade through how the primaries are different this year, or not different, which races could tip the balance of power in the state legislature, and how the campaign field is potentially influenced by national politics and subjects. So without further delay, today I have both of our Wyoming Public Media's state government reporters with us. Welcome, David Dudley and Chris Clements.
Excited to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And we have Dr. Andrew Garner as well. He's a professor of political science in the School of Politics, Public Affairs, and International Studies at the University of Wyoming. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So today we're going to take a big picture look at the primaries. Chris, how many seats are on the ballot for the state legislature this year?
Yeah, so let's start with the House. Every single seat is up for grabs there, and roughly half of Senate seats are open too, 15 out of 31. And about 80% of the races in both chambers feature at least two candidates, and that's slightly up from the 2022 election cycle when voters had even fewer options. The Republican Party currently dominates politics in Wyoming, as we all know, so the primary in August, it's going to decide the majority of these contested races. And something I want to point out, I'm really going to be watching this cycle for how many seats the far-right House Freedom Caucus will be able to pick up. They have roughly 26 seats right now, but at a town hall in Casper last year, Freedom Caucus officials mentioned wanting to expand their numbers by 10 more seats in 2024. And that goal is pretty apparent in their endorsements of candidates who are taking on more moderate Republicans.
Right. And David, what is it looking like in the federal elections? We have three representatives in Washington, D.C. How many are up for re-election this year?
We have the senior senator seat coming open and also Wyoming's single U.S. House seat. Both of those are on the ballot. For that senator seat, John Barrasso, he's held office for the past 17 years. He's currently the third ranking Republican in the party, and he also has presidential hopeful Donald Trump's backing to move even higher. He'll face off with John Holtz of Laramie and Reed Rasner of Casper. As I've talked with people on the scene in Cheyenne, the word untouchable comes up to describe Barrasso's place in the party. But Rasner, who's also a porter of former President Trump, and he's eager to test that idea. We also have Harriet Hageman, who won Wyoming's at-large House seat over Liz Cheney in 2022. She'll try to defend her seat from Steve Helling of Casper. Interesting fact, Helling ran as a Democrat during the last election, so I'll be interested to talk with him about switching parties.
And as Chris just mentioned, many races are going to be decided by the primary since there are few Democratic challengers. About 20% of races in this primary will be uncontested with only one person running. Andrew, is this unusual? What did 2022 look like?
So it's not at all unusual, and it's not unique to Wyoming either. There's been a national trend over the past 40 years or more of uncontested elections and more lopsided victories in state legislative elections. So in 2022, Wyoming Democrats only ran candidates in about a third of the district, and third-party candidates only ran in an additional 17%. So combined, about half of the elections in Wyoming were contested 2 years ago. And that obviously is a bit higher than it was, than it will be this coming election. And that's on par with what we see in most states around the country.
Got it. And as we keep on mentioning, the political climate in the state is very Republican-centric. There's actually currently 86 out of the 93 Senate and representative seats in Wyoming are GOP. And a lot of the races that we're talking about for the primaries are between moderate, or you could say old school Republicans, against more Wyoming Freedom Caucus-like candidates. When I was researching the different candidates and why they decided to run, many said that the quote-unquote Republicans in charge aren't doing anything, or they would just very bluntly say, if they get elected, they're going to join the Freedom Caucus. Andrew, how new is this phenomenon?
So primary challenges used to be a tool used by leadership to keep members in line and voting with majorities so they can pass the party's agenda. Now what we have are rank and file members using primaries as a way to change the composition of the party in the legislature and sometimes directly challenging the party leaders themselves in the primaries. That would have been unthinkable in the past. Anybody who challenged a party leader in a primary, for example, their career in the party would have been over. So as far as the change in why rank and file members are using primaries now, some of this is motivated by a desire to grow the size of their caucuses with the goal of promoting their policy agenda. Some of it is more establishment members trying to primary legislators they think are too extreme. And there's a whole host of, you know, range of motivations in the between those. But the main point is that there's been a major shift in recent years in how primaries have been used and who has used them. A shift from leadership promoting party discipline to rank and file members using it to change the composition of the party itself and even challenge a party leadership. And my best guess is that this change started within the last decade or so, and it's certainly become far more common in the past several years at both the national and the state level.
Right. And is this shift at all influenced by national politics, can we say?
It's really hard to know which individuals and which specific candidates are driven by national forces, but there is a lot of the trend that we're seeing across the country is driven by national politics. Remember that the Freedom Caucus started in Congress about 9 years ago and has now expanded to caucuses around 11 state legislatures. One of my colleagues here at UW in political science just published a fantastic book about the nationalization of congressional elections, and I think we're seeing the same dynamic filter down to state and local politics as well. Certainly, some of the same issues and same political dynamics at the national level are being reflected in the state and local politics. People are talking about the same policy concerns. They're using similar populist rhetoric, for example. And the strategy of using primary elections to move the party in a particular direction also reflects a national trend we're seeing in congressional elections from several groups, from the Freedom Caucus on the Republican side to the Progressive Caucus on the Democratic side.
Okay, so keeping that in mind, what are some state House and Senate races that are worth watching that might be Republican infighting? Let's start with you, Chris.
Yeah, so one is House Speaker Albert Summers of Pinedale. He's one of the most recognizable politicians in the state. He's decided to leave the House position he's held for the last 11 years. He's trying to become a senator now, so I'm keeping an eye on Senate District 14. And Summers is running as a more moderate Republican against Kemmer sheep rancher Laura Tulliver Pearson. Pearson has posted on social media aligning herself with the Freedom Caucus in the past, and they'll both face the third candidate in this race, former Navy submarine commander Bill Winnie of Bondurant.
And I'll be watching the Senate race between Tara Nethercott and Greg Smith in Cheyenne. Nethercott's an experienced lawmaker who served as a senator since 2017. She's been named Legislator of the Year by three different organizations, and she serves as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Her opponent, Greg Smith, says he's a former chemical weapons specialist in the U.S. Army. He has an MBA in operations management. Interesting fact, he's an Oregon transplant who's lived in Wyoming since 2005. A retiree, Smith told me that he loves Wyoming, but he has some complaints, some reservations about dysfunction in government. He also feels that there could be more done to bolster the business community, not only in Cheyenne, but across the state. He told me that he doesn't feel right about complaining without taking some kind of action. So rather than tapping out his discontent on the keyboard, he said that he chose to run for Senate. I'll also be watching the District 22 Senate race between Barry Crago and Mark Jennings. Both of those candidates have spent time in the Wyoming House of Representatives, and both are looking to join the Senate. Right now, Crago is on the Joint Judiciary Committee. He sponsored legislation to ensure that people who have been convicted of a felony for controlled substances are ineligible for a concealed carry permit. Jennings is a member of the Wyoming Freedom Caucus. He's also on the Joint Judiciary Committee. He made news this week after urging Governor Gordon to call a special session to protect Wyoming's coal interests in the Powder River Basin. When I called the governor's office, they declined to comment, but they did say that they had not received the letter.
So another part of this primary that seems a little unusual is an incognito nonprofit popping up, starting to endorse candidates that are more aligned with the Freedom Caucus. Chris, can you share what we know about Honor Wyoming?
Since it popped up last summer, it's been difficult for journalists and legislators to find out even just basic information about Honor Wyoming, like who actually leads it and who their major donors are. A big part of the group is ranking lawmakers based on what they call conservative bona fides, and they've spent close to $81,000 on social media ads so far, according to Jackson Hole News and Guide. Many of those ads were to support specific candidates. And Honor Wyoming recently had to refile their business licenses with the Secretary of State's office. And what I'll be watching for in particular will be when the group's tax documents become available on the IRS website for the first time. That'll happen sometime in the next year, year and a half. I mean, because they're a new nonprofit, their first filings just aren't available yet.
Right. And besides that, there's the Freedom Caucus and Wyoming Caucus. They've also have their own PACs. Chris, what are the details on the money that they've raised so far? And Andrew, then we'll come to you. What does that allow them to do? And what does that signal about the caucuses as they head into the election season?
Yeah, so both the Freedom Caucus PAC and the traditionally conservative Wyoming Caucus PAC formed last year. Something interesting I wanted to mention is that in their tax filings from 2023, you can see the Freedom Caucus PAC is falling pretty far behind the Wyoming Caucus just in terms of money raised from individuals. The Wyoming Caucus PAC brought in about $130,000 in total contributions, whereas the Freedom Caucus PAC saw only $43,000 come in that year.
So the money allows them to do a lot of things, everything from buying radio and television ads to doing what we call get out the vote operations, you know, paying volunteers to go knock on doors, make phone calls, all the whole range of campaign activities. And it's always better to have more money than less. But one thing I would say is that in a state like Wyoming, that kind of a money disparity may not give us a lot of insight into who's likely to win. So, for example, especially in a state like Wyoming, where retail politics is much more effective than air wars, Representative Hageman was outspent by former Representative Cheney 2-1, I believe, and Hageman still won by a lot. So you don't need a ton of money to compete in primaries in a state like Wyoming, where the population is small and primary elections don't involve a lot of voters. And that's even more true in state legislative districts with even smaller numbers of voters. The retail politics of knocking on doors and calling neighbors and those types of personal campaign tactics, they go a lot farther and are far more effective than large spending on radio and TV ads. And it doesn't take a lot of money to do those things if you have enough support from volunteers. I wouldn't necessarily read into the fact that the Wyoming Freedom Caucus PAC hasn't raised as much money. I don't think that can tell us a lot in terms of predicting the outcome of the primaries.
Thank you, everyone. That's the first of our new election series, The Road to Cheyenne. Thanks for being here with me, Chris, David, and Andrew. And if you have a question about voting, the electoral process, specific races, or candidates, feel free to give us a call and leave us a voicemail at 307-766-4314. We may use your voicemail on the show, or you can go on to wyomingpublicmedia.org and scroll down to our America Amplified banner to fill out a form to ask any questions. The Road to Cheyenne will be back on the next Open Spaces, June 28th, and we'll be looking at the northwest part of the state. Thanks. Up next, we look at how our neighbors down south are dealing with the reintroduction of wolves. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, a man's garden attracts a lot of attention from his neighbors and eventually leads to his dream job.
There's little shops kind of a few blocks from the house, and I would go in the shops and the person behind the counter would be like, "Hey, you're the guy from that house that has the garden." And I'd never seen these people before, never talked to them before.
I'm Megan Feary, Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
The Wyoming Public Radio app delivers great music 24/7. Stream Wyoming sounds, jazz Wyoming, and classical Wyoming. Download the Wyoming Public Radio app at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. As Wyoming deals with the backlash of a man allegedly abusing a wolf, a string of wolf attacks on livestock in Colorado's high country has become a flashpoint in the effort to restore the animal to its native range. Ranchers want the state to kill the wolves, which were reintroduced in Colorado just a few months ago. KUNC's Scott Franz reports for the Mountain West News Bureau that conservationists are urging patience.
Eric Odell and other wildlife biologists were excited last winter when they watched five wolves from Oregon sprint out of their cages into a snowy meadow in Grand County.
They're majestic animals. They're big, big animals and really exciting to see.
And for about 4 months, things were relatively quiet. But the restoration project is now experiencing some setbacks. One wolf was killed last month by a mountain lion. Another two are facing growing calls to be killed because they've been implicated in several attacks on cows. Ranchers in the area are anxious.
We're trying to get water on, we're trying to brand cattle, and yet here we are having to worry about a wolf eating our livelihood.
Tim Richard leads the Middle Park Stock Growers Association, and he lives close to where the wolves have killed cattle in Grand County. The state sent a range rider to help patrol the fields at night in a truck. Richard said it's helping, but the extra vigilance didn't stop a wolf from attacking another cow earlier this month.
We start losing too many, you're going to go out of business.
Some state lawmakers are also urging wildlife officials to kill some of the wolves. And Representative Richard Holtorf, an Eastern Plains rancher, compared Colorado's wolves to child predators.
When you release an apex predator anywhere near their ranches that they know are going to kill their livestock, it's paramount to putting a child predator in a grade school and expecting a different outcome.
As the wolves are blasted on ranches and in the halls of the Capitol, state wildlife officials are promoting non-lethal deterrents that range from bright lights to electric fencing. They're also refusing to kill the wolves because they say the pair implicated in the attacks has a den with potential pups, which is a boost for their restoration. Livestock attacks were also very much expected. Colorado will pay ranchers up to $15,000 per animal killed by wolves. And conservationists say killing the predators this early in their restoration could cost the state a lot more.
They might be the most valuable individual animals in all of Western North America right now.
Matt Barnes is a rangeland scientist who helped write the state's wolf management plan.
It'll be different a decade from now when there are hundreds of wolves, but right now, every wolf really matters.
He says in other Western states like Montana, only one out of every 10,000 cows are killed by wolves in the counties where they coexist. In Colorado, natural causes like disease and lightning kill far more livestock than wolves do. Barnes says shoring up ranches with non-lethal defenses is often a better solution than killing the predator.
Chances are, even if those wolves were lethally removed, they would be replaced by other wolves sooner or later, and those other wolves would probably find and exploit the same vulnerability.
People in Oregon are also invested in the fate of Colorado's wolves. That state donated 10 of them. Bethany Cotton is the conservation director for Cascadia Wildlands in Eugene.
I will be heartbroken if Colorado let some of those wolves be killed in the first year they're on the ground and before we have a chance to help folks learn to coexist.
Cotton says her group has also helped develop less expensive defensive measures for ranchers.
So it's really important that when we're talking about the challenges wolves bring, that we also talk about the benefits they can bring on the landscape too. Helping with disease control, they help keep other animals on the move.
Colorado's wildlife officials are now racing to deploy non-lethal defenses around the ranches near the wolves. Scott Franz, KUNC.
Mm-hmm. Wyoming for Palestine is a group with members across the state that advocates for freedom of Palestinians. They've held teach-ins about the Israel-Hamas war and organized a protest at the state capitol earlier this year. Recently, two of their members traveled to the West Bank, an area of Palestinian territory that's occupied by Israel. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger spoke to Dee Smith and Taylor Pinen about what they saw on their trip.
Can you talk about your organization, where they're located in Wyoming, some of the work they've been doing, and what the beliefs and goals are?
Yeah, so Wyoming for Palestine formed in early November. Many of us have been doing Palestinian liberation work on and off before this time, and some of us haven't. Some of us are newer to pro-Palestine and Palestinian liberation work. And it's a very grassroots organization. So again, we have member groups in Lander, in Casper, in Jackson Hole, in Cheyenne, and in Laramie. We believe that Palestinian people deserve the right to return, to remain, and to resist.
Why did you both travel almost 7,000 miles from Wyoming to the West Bank? Why now?
I'm a nurse as well, and I actually was thinking of trying to go to Gaza to help. I'm still thinking of that, but this felt like a really important place that I could actually support with my body and my smartphone and my privilege.
Yeah, so we answered a call from Palestinians for internationals, whether it be the US or Europe, mostly, to come and stand in solidarity as in a what is termed a protective presence. So a protective presence really just signifies that we are standing next to and documenting what is happening. So internationals are being asked to stand next to and with Palestinians in the West Bank who are facing persecution from Israeli settlers and the Israeli army.
Can you give people from Wyoming just a sense of density? Is it similar to Cheyenne, Denver, perhaps New York?
So population density, it's similar to Wyoming in that there's cities and then rural areas. Something that we don't see here in Wyoming is the very blatant segregation that's on signage and then military posts, Israeli military posts that maintain this segregation. If for people that have experience at the U.S.-Mexico border, like whether it be in California, Texas, or Arizona, it's much more similar to that where you see the border and then there's checkpoints everywhere. This wall is based off of the U.S.-Mexico border, same technology, same construction, and it's around the whole entirety of the West Bank. And then it also goes through and cuts through certain areas.
Of the media that Americans do see, especially in the West Bank, it's often through this kind of lens of violence, a child throwing a rock at a tank or the charred remains of a car while crowds walk around. From your experience, would you say that media portrayal is unfortunate, grim reality for more people than not there? Or would you say that it's an overrepresentation of the violence in a place that has more going on than just conflict?
Every day, people are just existing, grazing sheep and goats, harvesting their livelihood through agriculture. And that was really beautiful to see and like just be in community and build relationships with people. But that being said, yeah, it is every day spontaneous and routine violence. People just existing is always interrupted by settler violence. And I don't think that Western media is showing the full picture. We're not being told why people are fighting. I don't even want to say fighting. They're trying to expand these settlements. All settlers are armed with military-grade equipment. And Palestinians are obviously not armed with military-grade equipment because they're not backed by world powers like the United States and other European countries. And because we're not told this bigger picture, we don't understand why a kid would throw a rock.
Have either of you or any of the organizations involved in some of the protests and demonstrations had any contact with any local, state, or federal officials to perhaps talk about grievances, demands, policy objectives, that kind of thing?
Before our demonstration on the Capitol, me and my spouse, we went to a couple community meetings that Mark Gordon was at. There was actually one that was specifically around veterans and mental health. And my spouse was able to go inside and actually talk to Mark Gordon and ask him some questions. Interesting responses. I can't really speak to them exactly just because I wasn't there. But anti-Zionists in solidarity with Yemen and Palestine is really trying to make connections and seize the connections between the funding that we are giving Israel each year and continue to give throughout this genocide, and the lack of funding that is being used in Wyoming to take care of veterans.
Protesters and demonstrators in Wyoming have spoken in favor of a two-state solution. This tends to be a common answer among any conversation involving Israel and Palestine from the American perspective. And I'm wondering what the narrative around a two-state solution is like inside the West Bank.
We met many Palestinian Christians, Jewish Palestinians, especially in Bethlehem, whereas the majority of the Palestinians we were with in the South were Muslim. But all that to be said, it's not a monolith. Not a monolith in thought. Yeah, a two-state solution. The West Bank is a perfect example for why it doesn't work, because there is supposed shared jurisdiction, but Israeli powers overrun Palestinian authority, quite literally. That being said, people just want the violence to stop. That's the overall goal.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger speaking to Dee Smith and Taylor Pinen, members of Wyoming Palestine, on their recent trip to the West Bank. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Ivy Engel, today's audio producer, digital and social media producer. And thank you to Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.